Digging through the past is not that hard. Rusted cars and broken shards. Mining memories in an old wrecking yard. Echoes of laughter, whispers of pain. Time stands still, but the memories remain. In this graveyard of steel.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire. And y'all, presumably still y'all. All are welcome here in the Church of Internal Combustion. We just ask that you show up with an open heart. It is Thursday for me.
Thursday?
Been a busy day. Working on book stuff. Wrote the second oil astrology. Oh, there's my dadgum lens cap I lost. Look at there, man. As soon as you stop looking for it, you find it. Glad to have that. I have to do pixel mapping when I turn my phone on. It helps to have that lens cap. Because plus, I'm trying not to destroy my lens I paid entirely too much money for. Anyways, been a busy day. Getting things done around here before I go out of town for a couple of days. Go do some shows in San Antonio. Excited about that. Hope it goes well. Ticket sales aren't great right now, but they're... You know, that whole area has just got everything going on with the floods and stuff. It's just poor timing. I usually do really well in San Antonio. So, but it's been a good day. Got made some promos, did some cameos for people, filmed the oil astrology too. I got another piece that I'm working on that I started filming. And started writing another shop talk sketch and wrote some stuff in the book, some transitions and things, and added some stories that weren't in the original. There's going to be things like when you read this book, it's like even y'all day oneers, got the shirt on, even you day oneers, you're going to hear some stories in this book that aren't in that podcast because they're stories that we decided to flesh out and tell. And, it's just some stuff I had just forgot when I was doing the podcast and we're cutting it up and I'm trying to remember. I've also learned so much more about my mother's wreck since I did that episode. So I've learned a lot about that. And I've learned a lot about my Papa Clark I did not know. Like way back stories about him and his dad and how the Wrecking Yard came to be. So it's an interesting thing. My editor also teaches a class, and he's had his class looking at the book, see kind of like how they feel about it. And got a really nice letter from them today where they shared a lot of their thoughts about the book so far and, you know, things they think maybe I should change or not change. And some of their stuff I agree with a great deal, and they said very nice things. But and then some of their stuff, I don't know what they're talking about. But we'll get it all hammered out. It's going to be great. I'm so excited about it. It's really all I can think about these days. I'm so just tickled pink working on this thing. So it's been a good day. It's been a productive Thursday. Hope you guys have had a good week. Hope you've managed to overcome whatever things are getting in your way this week. I've got a little battle I'm dealing with. I'm not going to go into too much detail on, but it's just another one of them fights in life you got to do sometime. And like most fights when you get older, they require money. And so I'm doing the best I can with that right now. But it'll all get better. I'm not concerned about it. I just figure it's something trying to guide me this way or that way, as the universe will do from time to time. Sometimes you need a little shove. You know what I mean? Let's do some sponsor copy. Let's get on this. I'm excited. Today's story centers around a 1982 Suzuki GS1100 I owned for a little short period of time. And you guys have been around. You've heard all the stories. I'm going to skip over a lot of that stuff. I'm not going to rehash it, but this is like that period of time, like when I left Jacksonville, Florida, and went down and was working in Mexico on these gas turbine jobs doing NDT. And this is a lot of this is about my experiences working down there and experimenting a little bit with my health and my sanity. And I'm about 23 years old, I think, is what I've nailed it down. I'm about 23 years old. It's right after Y2K. And I've left Florida to go to Mexico to work a project for MQS Cooper Heat for Duke Hidalgo Energy. And I bought that little... Anyway, we'll get into it. But so if you knew, some of this might feel a little out of context to you. And I would recommend watching the first Trans Am episode. And... I think that's about the only one that's really going to help you in this context, because I haven't really talked a lot about this very specific time in my life. It was real short, less than a year. Anyways, we'll get into it. Let's do some sponsor copy. If you've got a business or a brand and you're looking to get it in front of real folks who actually listen, I want to help you do that. The Wrecking Yard is one of the fastest growing shows out there, averaging 8,000 to 10,000 downloads a week. I got to change that. It's like 13% engagement right now, which is killer engagement. We're on every major podcast platform and broadcast live and video on YouTube. Folks who tune in, y'all are loyal, sharp. They show up for honest stories from the Southern Piney Woods, lessons from the junkyard, and some raw, hilarious self-reflection, which you don't hear a lot of these days. When I talk about a product I believe in, people pay attention. And right now we've got sponsor spots open, your name, your logo, even your hat or your shirt, front and center on a podcast that's already signed a book deal and been optioned for TV and film. If that sounds like your kind of ride, email jwlcomedy@gmail.com and let's grow together. My motto is all ships rise. Once again, that is jwlcomedy@gmail.com. Also, if you're interested in my Day Oneer shirt, I'm trying to kind of get a feel for like how many people are interested and want one. But, Amy Iris, who created this shirt for me, a big fan of the show and Day Oneer herself, sent us the graphic files so that we could recreate the shirt. And I really love it. I don't think I would change nothing about it. So let me know in the comments if that's something you're interested in, if you'd be interested in ordering a shirt. Because so I might try to get a bunch of them printed and just a specific batch order for my Day Oneers. Right? I just love you guys, and it's so funny. I get all these emails now from these people that are just now tuning into the podcast. I'm like, bro, you just need to go back. Just need to go back and watch from the beginning. You'll get there. Ooh. Okay. Cool. That was a little runny. A little hot out here. Oh, man, I thought it was hotter than that. When I opened the doors of this garage earlier, I came out here, I filmed Oil Astrology and I filmed some other quick stuff and some promo stuff. And when I came in here and sat down to start filming, I'm not a big sweater, but sweat was just pouring off. Felt like a freaking convection oven in here. So I opened them doors up. I got my little AC going there, but yeah, it was hot in here earlier. I'm surprised thermostat has dropped that much from my efforts. It's also it's about 8 o'clock in the PM. So it's starting to cool off just a little bit. Houston's weird. It may be like this where you live too, but I always suspect it's because of all the concrete. But what happens here is after it gets dark, then it gets hotter for a little while. And that's just a really fun bonus benefit of living in a swamp. It's good times. Now, before we get into real stories, close calls, long nights, dumb decisions, and windburned mornings, I want to take a second to talk about the machine itself. The beast in question, 1982 Suzuki GS1100. You know, to understand what kind of bike this was, you got to rewind the tape a bit back to the mid-70s. I know some of you guys got experience. We've talked in the comments. Suzuki at the time wasn't known for any four strokes, but especially any big four stroke bruisers. They were a two stroke company through and proud of it. Their most famous machine before the GS series was the GT750, and you may know it better by its nickname, the Water Buffalo. That bike was something else. It was a 738cc water cooled two stroke triple. First Japanese production bike to come with liquid coolant. It was smooth, torquey, and heavy as a ham sandwich in August. It made about 67 horsepower, weighed over 550 pounds wet, and drank gas like it was trying to end the oil crisis all by itself. But people loved them. You try to get your hands on one now, they go pretty high dollar. It was a touring machine in two-stroke clothing. Had power delivery. It was more like a V8 boat motor than a high-rev screamer. The GT750 proved Suzuki could play in the heavyweight class, but it also showed they needed to evolve. The era of big four-stroke motorcycles was coming fast in the 70s. That brings us to the GS. Suzuki launched the GS series in 1976 with the GS750. It was their first proper four-stroke motorcycle since like the 50s. They made one that's called a Coletta or something like that. And this wasn't just a half-hearted experiment. It was a straight-up declaration of war. They wanted to get in a fight. Four cylinders, dual overhead cams, air-cooled with a clean, tough-looking double cradle frame. And the handling was where it made its name. Unlike the Honda CB750, which I rode a mess of, and I love them, but they felt top-heavy, big time. The 750 never felt really well-balanced to me. The Kawasaki Z1 was just all speed and no handling at all. If you could point it in a straight line, that thing was good to go. The GS750 felt planted, grounded, gave riders confidence, something sorely missing from some of its contemporaries. And from there, the GS family expanded like a church directory. GS400s, GS550s, GS1000s. Suzuki was filling every market cap they possibly could. Market gap. But the real heavyweight champion was still coming. The 1100 landed in 1980. By 82, it was a refined road rocket. A dual overhead cam, inline four, 1,074cc displacement, four valves per cylinder, 9-7-1 compression ratio, around 90 horsepower at the crank. There's raw muscle in a steel frame, ready to go toe-to-toe with the biggest and the baddest. Now, to understand the turf Suzuki was stepping into, we got to talk about the big three in the North American motorcycle market at that time. And that was Honda, Kawasaki, and Yamaha. Honda was the elder statesman. They changed the world in 1969 with the CB750, four cylinders, front disc brake, electric start. That was the bike that knocked Harley off its perch right before Harley went into all its quality control issues. And it set the template for what a modern motorcycle would be. Honda's reputation was bulletproof. They made reliable, polished machines with strong dealer support and a squeaky clean brand image. Kawasaki, on the other hand, you know, but they're the wild child, right? A Z1900 was a straight line missile. It was faster than just about anything on the road. They had a reputation for power, for bravado, and a little bit of madness. If Honda was the honor student, Kawasaki was the kid who smoked behind the bleachers and still aced the test. Yamaha, they kind of split the difference. You know, they leaned into innovation, monoshock rear suspensions, lightweight two strokes, early four stroke efforts that felt a little more European. XS750 Triple was their early four stroke shaft drive attempt. And it handled well, but it didn't quite catch fire with the buyers. But in my mind, it is the most balanced motorcycle I ever rode in my life. I would hop on an XS750 tomorrow and take off on it without even having not been on a motorcycle in years. That bike was so well balanced. So Suzuki's late to the party, but they come loaded. The GS series was a swing at the crown, and the GS1100 was a knockout punch. Carbs, talk a little more about the tech. The carbs were the Mikuni BS34s, four of them. Constant velocity carbs, I mean, they gave smooth fuel delivery, but the tuning on them was a pain in the ass. If one of those was out of sync, you felt it. Had a clutch, a wet multiplate setup, paired with a 5-speed transmission and chain drive. No shaft, no belt, just raw metal on metal efficiency. Frame was steel, heavy, but stiff, double cradle design, big backbone. It gave it a planted feel, especially at speed. Front forks were 37 millimeter telescopic tubes with a modest amount of preload adjustment. The rear shocks were twin coilovers. It wasn't a sophisticated suspension setup, even for the time, but it was right in line with making that bike stick to the ground. Had triple disc brakes, single piston caliper, solid rotors, no floating hardware. It's the kind of setup that demanded your hands be kind of strong and brake early. That's what I can tell you about that bike. If you see the curve, you already started braking too late. This thing, mine just kind of stopped when it wanted to. And if it was raining, then you should just push the clutch in and have a little conversation with the Lord about what's about to happen to you. Ergonomically, it's tall and wide. Had a real high seat, 31-inch seat height, long reach to the bars. Had a decent-sized gas tank on it, so you get some decent, range out of them. Analog gauges, right? Just some old school perfection. Big old round speedo and attack. Mine had a fuel light, but I never could trust that fuel light. I had to just open the tank and look. It had idiot lights, but they were so inconsistent with how they worked, I never could tell what, if any of them meant anything. Didn't have no big old fat tires on it, Pretty skinny tires up front and out back. Which they worked fine as long as you didn't get too stupid with it. They'd let go quicker than a borrowed fishing rod if you tried to push too hard in the corner, though. But despite all the weight and age and mechanical clatter, the GS1100 felt alive. It was a motorcycle that made you do the work. It didn't flatter you. It didn't correct your mistakes. It wasn't perfectly bad. It didn't beep or buzz. It just went. And if you did it right, if you planned your quarters and you feathered your clutch and rolled the throttle open like a gentleman, it would reward you with a sound, a feel, a momentum that's hard to describe and even harder to forget. Riding one today was like stepping into a different language with where motorcycles are now. There's no substitute for those older machines, though, in that mechanical intimacy. When for a while, there was nothing on the road like this thing. But there's no something about riding an older bike like that. You have to pay a little more attention. You have to be a little more careful. In my mind, it makes a little better rider of you. When I was 23, I had found myself living in Jacksonville, Florida for a bit. I was pretty aimless. Just broke up with a gal. Remember that. I was seeing another gal down in Vero Beach, but it wasn't anything serious. Rooming with my cousin Dominic, sharing a room with my cousin Dominic. Me and him were real tight. We were having a good time, getting just hang out on the rig. And I had got a job working for MQS Cooper Heat right there locally out of Jacksonville. I know I was there for New Year's Eve on Y2K because I saw Charlie Daniels in concert and he played Freebird on electric fiddle and blew my mind. He did a 3-song encore. He did ZZ Top. I don't remember what ZZ Top song he did. And he did Ramblin' Man by the Allman Brothers. It was a tribute to Southern Rock. And then he closed out with this insane 15-minute version of Freebird on an electric fiddle that he just shredded. He shredded the bow, everything. It was crazy. It was an exciting show. So I figured this must be just a few months after. Because I remember when I first got there, they had a lot of work, and then their work kind of slowed down. But there was a mess of projects going on in Texas down the Rio Grande Valley. There was a company called Duke Hidalgo Energy was building all these old gas turbine plants along the border. Some of them in Mexico, some of them in Texas. And they said, man, you know, we just ain't got a lot of work for you right now, but we need RT guy, radiography techs. We need you guys down there in Rio Grande Valley. I was like, well, I ain't never been down there too much. Go down there, you know, sounds fun. I get to go to Mexico, get to go to a different country. But Mexico is very different. Right? All the cartel stuff wasn't like a big, you could just go back and forth across the border. Everybody was pretty chill. I mean, you had to watch your wallet, but it was pretty chill. Anyways, they offered me the gig. Go down there and run the night shift for the NDT. It was a gas turbine site. It was somewhere near Edinburgh, the first one that I went to. And something I realized I talk about radiography. Me and my editor have been talking about this. Some of you don't actually know what it is. So radiography, industrial radiography, which is what I did a lot of, is you use a sealed gamma radioactive source that is it's mounted in a lead container with like an S tube through it. And there's a set of cranks on this end, and there's a guide tube on this end. And then you do equations to figure out how long to expose that source, that radiation, to take a picture of a weld through metal or take a picture of metal or something really thick. And, you know, you have to go out there, set your film up and all that stuff and calculate your shot. And that's what I was doing. I was doing a mess of it. And it was kind of a gravy gig. We had to shoot cobalt. So cobalt, the isotope we normally used when we were doing radiography was iridium 192. But when you're shooting through like thicker stuff, like cracker casing and stuff like that's real thick, you have to have something called cobalt 60, which is a much higher energy isotope and requires a bit more shielding and things like that to work with it safely. It's kind of a sketchy job if you don't pay attention to what you're doing, but if you do pay attention to what you're doing, follow the rules, do the math right, most people never get hurt doing it. But it's basically you're working with radiation all day, and you're trying to expose it and keep yourself shielded and trying not to cook your insides. That gig was gravy, because we would get out to work. I think my shift was from, seven to seven. They usually let us go early in the morning because all our stuff was done, but we'd still get that 12-hour ticket. We'd usually get out of there like 5, 6 in the morning. And most of the time we would have all our shots finished and I would have already developed the film and read the film and wrote all my reports by midnight. And then me and my, whoever my helper was, for a long time, this dude named Freddie. Me and Freddie would just chill out in the dark room, smoke cigarettes, bullshit, play cards, tell lies, all that good stuff. And some of you, I've told you, that was my first experience with the old Bam Bam powder. It was right around that time, and whew, that was quite a ride. But it was also my first experience with a little cactus called peyote. Peyote is just, it's a little big old cactus. Don't look like much. Grows low to the ground down in the Rio Grande Valley, mostly around Roma, Texas, and into northern Mexico. No spines. It's just a soft, round, kind of grayish green button barely poking up from the dirt. Kind of looks like the top of a biscuit. It's got tufts of little white fuzz on it. When it's harvested, that top part gets cut, sliced, and dried and turned into what they call buttons. But don't let the size fool you. Those little buttons pack a wallop. Inside that little cactus is a cocktail of alkaloids. Mescaline's the main one. That'll set off a full-blown sensory jamboree. Most folks who take it in ceremony experience vivid visions, not just colors and patterns, but whole scenes, animals, ancestors, spirit journeys. It ain't just a light show either. You'll smell things, you'll hear things, feel waves move through you like music underwater. It's not like messing with, it's a different mushrooms. But before you get to any kind of enlightenment, the first thing that peyote does is make you purge, and it's bitter. It's real bitter. It's like chewing on regret and battery acid. And it'll turn your stomach inside out. That's the first part of it. Is you just get nauseous and you're gonna lose your guts. That's all there is to it. Go somewhere where you can make a mess. I mean, you're gonna sweat like you're being exercised. That's part of it. According to the folklore, that's, you know, the physical cleansing is seen as spiritual. Kind of like you're wringing out your soul before you step into another world. Legally, it's a bit of a tangle. Peyote is classified as a Schedule I drug federally, same as heroin. But in Texas, there's an exemption for members of the Native American church as long as they've got at least 25% Native blood. The law was passed in 69, mostly to protect ceremonial use. But it's still a bit of a minefield. Suppliers have to register, and enforcement is a mess. Meanwhile, the cactus itself is endangered in some places because it grows slow. It takes years to mature, and the land it thrives on keeps getting bulldozed or fenced off. So what you got is a sacred plant rooted deep in Native American tradition, outlawed by the folks who never understood it, and now fading from the land it grew in. It's not just a hallucination. It's a story. It's a ceremony and a mirror, depending on who's holding it. My first time experiencing, I was an experimental guy then. I was quick to say yes. And there was this fellow, this welder out there on the night shift, who I suspect was mostly Mexican, but definitely had some Native American features and such, and some Native American background. Man, I wish I could remember what that did. He had a funny name, too. Not like funny, like I wouldn't make fun of somebody's culture. It was like Eugene or something. It was something real funny. Always made me laugh that this guy had that name. But he knew me and Freddie partied a little bit, and he told me one night, he said, you ought to try these little buttons I got. He said, I get them from my cousin. He said, they'll get you right with the wind, brother. That's what he told me. They'll get you right with the wind. And I was like, well, that sounds fun. I ain't never been right with the wind. Guess I could try getting right with the wind. And one night after we get done shooting all our shots and doing all our stuff, me and Freddie decide that we're going to chew up one of these a piece, which is not, you know, everybody's dosage is different, but it was also my first time I chewed this thing up. And I'm telling you, 25 minutes later, I'm standing on the side of the dark room talking to Jesus, holding my hand on the side of the wall and losing everything in my stomach and sweating like my blood pressure, sweating like I was in an oven. You know, just like I was being cooked from the inside out. But after that part, I don't know, it's like I could hear everything, dude. I could hear the crunch of somebody's boot on the gravel across the plant, you know, and there wasn't hardly anybody out there. We worked nights by ourselves mostly, a couple welders for pickup and stuff like that. I could hear everything. That's what I can't remember. And I was kind of tripping. We went back in the dark room and we're kind of talking about this experience we're having. Somebody knocked on the darkroom door, dude. I thought they were going to knock the darkroom over. It sounded so loud to me. I jumped off the damn tanks like, what the sh... Good God, my... I sound like a police knock. I don't like that, you know? And open door, it's one of the inspectors from the night shift. And he said, Jerry, I'm so sorry. When we gave you the list of welds to shoot earlier, we forgot one over on this little tower over here. A tower. Cool. He said, but it's got to be done tonight. So you're going to have to get your gear out and go out there and shoot that weld. And I was like, all right. In about an hour, I'll be out there and shoot it. He shuts the door, leaves. Me and Freddie are freaking out. I'm like, I can't. I got to go climb 40 feet, which don't sound like that high, but it is when you are. And I got to go climb 40 foot of scaffolding. And Freddie's got to climb 40 foot of scaffolding. So we get that camera up there and shoot this weld. And I think I spent about 30 minutes in that dark room, kind of panicking a little bit. And finally, she's like, let's go, right? And I mean, we're walking through that plant. And all the colors are so vivid. Everything's so bright. I'm not like hallucinating or anything, but everything just, you know, it was kind of a low dose. Everything's just bright. Everything's real vivid. And I'm like, how long does this stuff last, Freddie? And Freddie's like, I don't know. I forgot to ask him. And I was like, man, that feels like a question that we should have made a priority before we ate these. You're young and dumb, making all the dumbest decisions. I remember I was climbing that tower, and I was feeling like guilty and like I wasn't having a good time then. And I could hear the way my boots sounded on the ladder, like the scrape of my boots when I would go to a next step. And every time I heard that scrape, I was like, you're about to fall off this thing and die in a really painful way. There's a bunch of pipes down there, and you're sure to land on the little 4-inch one that's going to land right in the middle of your back and break your back. Like, that's got to be the way this goes. And climbing up there, and I'm almost to the top, bro. I did not know about the auditory hallucinations. So my mom had this, the way my mom would say my name, she'd go, Jerry Wayne. Like, and that was the way she said it when she had had enough of me. When I was acting up a little too much, cutting up a little too much, or when I was just being a little too ridiculous. Jerry Wayne. And I swear to God, when I got on the top rug of that ladder, I heard it. I like she was standing next to me on the ladder. Jerry Wayne. And I was like, I'm sorry, Mom. But I got to do this. It was like I was being admonished by a ghost in the air or something. It was wild. And we'd already shot one shot like that night. So we already had the calculations. So thankfully, we didn't have to do no math. We set it up. Freddie went and run a barricade and shot those shots. And then I threw the film down to Freddie. And Freddie was pretty good at developing. I said, go develop that film and come back and tell me that film's clean before I climb back down and lower this camera. You know, camera weighs like 85 pounds and the crank's another 20 pounds or so. Like, and then my jig and all my stuff, you know, it was 100 pounds worth of crap I had to tote down this ladder. Feels like Freddie's gone for 2 hours, man. Developed some 15-minute film. But I know my time was throw it off because he come back. He's like, it's good. I was like, cool. And I got the rope, tied my stuff, started lowering it down to him. And I was like, man, it's got to be like 3 a.m., right? And he goes, no, bro, it's 1:30. What? I've been up here for hours. How in the hell is it 1:30? Get all the stuff down to him, climb my shaky ass down off that ladder. Instantly made resolution never to experiment with no buttons at work again. That was a bad call. But did kind of want to get some more because I liked the way it made me feel, you know, until I had to go do scary shit. I've been down there, I don't know, maybe 6-7 weeks working down there. We're making good money. We're making pretty good cash, pretty good pay, plus per diem. We were all staying in this cheap, the Edinburgh Motor Lodge. It was real cheap. And we were getting a group discount for the company. And so, and it didn't cost, you know, down in the valley back in those days, man, it didn't cost nothing to eat. You can go to Mexico, you can eat even cheaper over in Mexico, you know. And we used to go back and forth to Reynosa a lot, because me and Freddie were off during the day. A lot of times we would just go load up in one of the pickups and run over there to the border. We couldn't drive the trucks back and forth across the border. Park, we walk across the border in Reynosa, catch a cab wherever we wanted to go, go hang out in Reynosa for the day. Reynosa was a dirty, sneaky little border town, but it could be a fun place once you made some friends. And we had made some friends. Freddie spoke really good. Freddie was, I think he might have been half Mexican, but he spoke really good Spanish. He's crazy as shit, but dude speaks Spanish. And got us into some fun times down there. We had some good times. But I've been out there, you know, maybe a month or so. And there's this little used car dealership that I would drive by on the way back to the motel. And that used car dealership is just one of those old chain link fence and banner kind of operations, you know, finance in-house, that kind of stuff. And I drove by it. I saw that bike sitting out there on the lot one day. It was black, beautiful black. It just looked mean, man. I remember I saw it, and what it really reminded me of was, y'all remember that movie called The Principal with John Belushi or Jim Belushi? The Principal with Jim Belushi? And he rode a motorcycle, and it, for whatever reason, that GS 1100 reminded me of that motorcycle he had. I found out years later that he was actually riding a Honda 750 Shadow in that movie. But I went back to the motel at night, and boy, I kept thinking about that motorbike, how much I'd like to have it. I said, man, I'll stop there tomorrow and see what they want for it. And stopped in the next day, a little Hispanic dude comes out there. We chit chat a little bit about the bike. He said, yeah, he said, it's in pretty good shape. He said, I took it in kind of a trade deal and going to try to see what I can get for it. And we hemmed and hauled. We got to $1,200 on that motorbike, which wasn't cheap for one of those bikes at the time, but the thing was pretty perfect. It was in clean shape. He'd let me start it up. 750 run good. And I was making good money, you know. I didn't have no wife. I didn't have no kids. I wasn't really thinking about anything. My idea of long-term planning back in those days was buying an extra pack of cigarettes so I didn't run out in the morning. So I bought that bike. Freddie drove me over there in the pickup. I picked it up, rode it back to the motel, and took it out a little later that afternoon and run it up and down the highway. There's a lot of empty open highway out there, and that was a good place to have a motorbike like that. That thing. Like I said, you had to be on them brakes quick, Bubba. You had to be on them brakes. Strong hands on them brakes and that clutch pedal, but it was fun running a bike, and it handled pretty good, you know. It felt good. It felt good. You get it up to speed, it felt real good. It was a little clumsy at low speeds. You know, 20, 30 miles an hour, it felt like you might want to drop it or jerk it a little too hard. There was this maid that worked at the Motor Lodge. I think she was probably about 30 years old. And I think her name was Maria. Pretty sure she's a Mexican gal. Like she was from the valley. And she always called me Widow. And me and her got along pretty good. I would hang out. She'd sit out there and fold the sheets and stuff. And sometimes I'd sit out there and just bullshit with her. She was just kind of a cool chick, you know. She'd tell me about her kids and stuff like that. And wasn't trying to do nothing with her. We were just buddies, but she found this 23-year-old widow interesting to talk to, and we'd sit there and chit-chat. We liked talking about music the most. She was really into 60s rock and roll, and so that's music. That's an era of music I'm just in love with and always have been. So we talked about music all the time. And I would tell her about music my mom taught me about growing up and turn her on to new things. And she was really cool. She told me, she said, you keep a lot of cash in your room. And I was like, yeah, but I got it hidden. She goes, yeah, but you got it hidden in a stupid place. And I was like, okay, good to know. She goes, here's what you do. And she went into the office. And she come back out a little later. And she had this little mustard bottle. And it was all rinsed out and clean. She goes, I saved this for you. I said, what do I do with this? She goes, why do you roll your money up and put it in that mustard bottle, put it in that refrigerator? She goes, I'm never going to steal your money, but there's girls that work here at Will. And she goes, there's people get robbed out here, get their hotel doors kicked in, looking for money and stuff like that. And they won't ever think to look for that mustard bottle. And so I was, because of my per diem, I was getting in cash and I had a lot of cash. And I wasn't big into bank accounts and being organized back then. So I always had a wad of cash and I would roll it up, keep it in that mustard bottle in my refrigerator. Hey, you know what? A couple of them dudes out there got robbed. But you know who never did get robbed? This guy right here, man. Never did get robbed one time. Me and her would talk, and I had told her about the peyote buttons. And she had some experience with it. She knew about it. She kept telling me, she was telling me about this place called Laguna Seca. And it's up the road just a ways from Edinburgh. And she told me all this history about it, about how the very first orange trees planted in the valley were planted there. And it had all this wild history from like the 1870s or something to it. And I wish I'd listened better, or paid more attention. But there was orange groves out there, man. I would take that motorbike every once in a while out there. I'd ride up there in the morning, you know. Especially got off work like 5:36, I'd hop on that bike and I'd be hitting Laguna Seca by the time the sun come up. And it just looked cool coming up through the orange trees and a bunch of little empty roads out there. A bunch of little places you can just get off and be left alone, you know. You might see migrant workers ride by on the back of a pickup, but they don't give a shit about you. Ain't their business and what they're doing ain't yours, you know. It's one of them places where you can still get lost a little bit if you want to get lost. I did. I went out there one morning, man. I think I did it a couple times, actually. But one morning I went out there, Wynn, get yourself right with Wynn, Eugene, and give me a little bag of these peyote buttons. I paid him for them, of course. And Freddie never wanted to mess with it again. Freddie didn't enjoy his experience, but there was something about mine that I enjoyed. There was something, I don't know. Maybe it was spiritual or something like that. I don't know. I can't tell you that. I'm not a smart enough man to tell you all that. But I'd enjoyed it. And so I was kind of smart about it. You know, I go out there. The guy told me, he said, on the edges is where it's the strongest, you know. So if you're not trying to go to the moon, just chew a little bit off the edge and you get yourself a little 4 or 5 hour ride. That's nice, manageable, good time. So that's what one morning I went out there real early. I left the plant site at like 5 a.m., got back to the motel, got on my bike, and I rode up there to Laguna Seca, and I had found this little spot where I could kind of sit. It wasn't much of a hill, but it's kind of like a little roll, you know, one of those just like maybe had 3 foot of rise in it total, like a little berm type situation. And I rode that Suzuki up there and I parked it on top of that berm and I just sat there on the ground, man, and got off one of them little buttons and I brought myself water. I prepared. And I had my little, at the time I had a Sony Discman and I would keep it. I had a strap for it so I could strap it in my leg so I could wear it while I rode my motorcycle and listen to music. I had my little Sony Discman, and I only had like 3 CDs for it at the time. I just started buying CDs when I got down there, and I had Americana by The Offspring. I think I also had whatever the Eminem album had White America on it, and Superman and all that stuff. And I had Johnny Cash Greatest Hits. What was the other one? Third Eye Blind. The other one was the Third Eye Blind album. One that had Jumper on it. Wish You Would Step Back From the Ledge, My Friend. Right. And I put that Third Eye Blind album in. It was a good album. I wish I could remember the name of that album. It's a good ass album. I enjoyed it a great deal. Got off my little button. Sure enough, 25, 30 minutes later, get up, walk down the little side of that hill, puke my guts out, sweat right through my clothes. Not near as bad as the first time. And then I went back and I just sat on that hill and listened to my music. And it was just peaceful, I guess. But I was thinking about all kind of stuff and stuff of my own family and the direction my life was taking and how I was just kind of aimless and I didn't have nothing pointing me yet. I didn't have no, there wasn't anything guiding me right then, you know? It was just me. I was like a pinball, just bouncing around the country, doing whatever, you know? I didn't have any plans for the future. I wasn't sure enough about the future to try to even make plans at that point. If I'd known I was going to live to 48, I would have made a lot more plans when I was 23. Because holy hell, I just didn't see that back then. But I remember I sat there all day. I think I did it a couple times because I have kind of mixed memories about it. But I just remember I just sit there. I had some old sunglasses and like safety glass sunglasses, those old mirror shade ones. And I was just watching the colors of the sun as it come up and lit up them orange trees and the way the shadows moved on the ground. I sat there all day and watched the way the sun and the shadows moved on the ground and watched the way the sun would paint one side of them trees gold and then paint some of the ground gold. And then as it moved, it would go more to a white hot color as it got higher in the sky. And then towards the end of the day, it started painting the sides of the trees copper. And it was a deeply moving experience, deeply moving experience. Changed something in me. I'm 100% sure that it changed something in me. I don't know what, but it did change something. And I got, you know, that was kind of becoming my favorite thing to do is get on that Suzuki in the morning when I got off work and just go ride for an hour or two. There's plenty of places to ride out there. You can just get lost. You can just have yourself a good old time, you know. Not doing that stuff, but just riding motorbike, you know, just enjoying being on that motorbike. A lot of the guys were going to the, you know, the boys town, the prostitution places and stuff. And I was still pretty naive and that all kind of grossed me out. I just wasn't my type of shit. So I didn't always, and then the other guys wanted to go drink and, you know, and I wasn't a big drinker back then. Oh, Freddie got a little too hard off in the booger sugar, man. He stopped showing up to work. He started, he shacked up with some gal down there, and I don't know what all happened with him, but all I know is they fired Freddie, and they sent me a replacement out of Houston. And my replacement was a guy named VJ, an Indian man named VJ. And for every bit as fun and entertaining as Freddie was, VJ was not. It was a wet blanket the size of San Antonio got dumped on me. And VJ was by the rules. Everything speak. I'm sure the company loved him. And I spent a lot of time by myself after that, you know, just hanging out, riding a motorbike. I go hang out with Maria. Go to some of the clubs and to some of the bars in town during the day. Every once in a while, I have a beer or two. But just started spending a lot of time solitary. In the meantime, I had started talking to my ex-girlfriend in Houston and on the phone. And we were sort of talking about, you know, spending some time together when I got back to Houston. And guys in Florida said, man, we still ain't got much work here in Florida, so if you want to go work out in the Houston office, for a little while you can until we get something cracking here. And that's also when I found out that my Trans Am got towed. I parked my Trans Am at the building where I worked at in Jacksonville. And then sometime in the course of the time, several months I was down working on the Texas border, thinking that my car would be there for me when I got back. Now, this is some of you guys know, this is after a transmission shop done ruined this car, and it was going to need all kind of work. I was so pissed about it. But I get a letter in the mail telling me they've crushed my Trans Am. I don't believe they crushed it. I think somebody put a lien on it, got a title on it. But what happened is that company I was working for, they moved locations and forgot to tell the guy working in Texas that they moved locations. And so my car sat there when the new owner took it over. They had it towed off, unbeknownst to me. It was about the time I found all that out. So I was kind of pissed at the company. I wasn't real happy. And they finally called down. They said, man, we got a job that needs to start in Houston. We need you guys to bring all the equipment back up here to Houston. So VJ was going to drive the truck. And this is like December. And I was going to ride my motorcycle all the way up 59 back into Houston. Hadn't spent a lot of time riding a motorcycle in the cold at that point. I remember by the time I got to Houston, I had stopped at two gas stations and gotten an extra pair of cotton gloves. My hands were just like this, you know, because it was only like, I mean, this is South Texas, so it was only like 50, you know, 50, 48 degrees, something like that. But at 60 and 70 miles an hour, that will eat your lunch, especially if you ain't dressed for it. And I was not dressed for it. I had a leather jacket, but it was a Texas leather jacket. It wasn't built for stuff like that. And I had a Bell helmet. So luckily, you know, but this, whoo, I remember this little area of my throat was just raw and red. It felt like stinging needles. It started like sprinkling a little bit at one point, and it felt like stinging needles hit me in the neck. Coming up that highway. All right. I used to, every once in a while, I'd tuck back in behind the darkroom truck and get out of the wind for a little while, as long as I could stay and going as slow as VJ was going. And then after I passed him up and got too far from him, I'd look for an 18-wheeler, and I would tuck dangerously close in the back of them 18-wheelers, especially them kind of got them flaps out the back that kind of whirlywind the wind. And that's a technical term, whirlywind the wind. And I'd just be back there shaking because that wind would be blowing me around, but at least I was out of the main wind, you know. Finally made it to Houston. Longtime listeners know the story there. I got a little altercation with my boss. One of the few altercations I ever won, but did not win because did lose my job, but back in those days, it was easy to get another job, quick, fast, and in a jiffy. Wasn't too concerned about it. I had a big old wad of money in my pocket. I think I just bought another little pickup. I think that's when I bought a little S10 that I was running around in for a while. I can't remember. But I had that motorbike. I remember what made me go. I decided to take a ride. I decided I was going to take the motorcycle. I was going to ride up to East Texas. And I know I was looking for Uncle Bobby. I was going to go hunt Uncle Bobby down. I knew he had an apartment over in Longview. I think he might have been DJing again for a little while. I may be wrong about that. I can't remember. I think maybe he was DJing and doing the hot tub stuff at the time. I rode on up there. I got a hold of him. Hell yeah, nephew. Come on. I rode up there on like a Friday. Got there, I don't know. It was probably just getting dark when I pulled into Longview and went to his apartment complex. And he's hanging out on the balcony. He's waiting for me. He was on the way. He said, call your mom and tell your mama you're here. That kind of shit. Which it did. So it was a dutiful son. Went up there, hung out with him, man. I guess maybe it was a little earlier in the day back, because we went and got some food. And we was coming back to get some food. We got in his truck. It was cold outside. And we got in his pickup. We get some food. He showed me his new CD player. And I got my little bag there with my four or five CDs in it. And I'm like, hell yeah, you got to listen to this. We listened a little bit of The Offspring, and he was into that. And he was always into new music. And I threw the Johnny Cash in there, and he wasn't the biggest Johnny Cash fan. He was cool with Johnny, but he wasn't the biggest Johnny Cash fan. And I remember Sunday Morning Coming Down comes on, and I start singing Sunday Morning Coming Down. And he just turns the stereo off. He was so exasperated. He's like, man, that's not even a good version of that song, man. I said, what are you talking about? That's the only version I know. He said, that's not the good version of that song. And so he's like, all right, man. And so he drives us to a pawn shop. And we go to the pawn shop, and he scans us. This is back when pawn shops had CDs and cassettes for sale. And he scans through all the CDs they got. He's like, no. And so we go to another pawn shop over in Longview. He goes through the CDs. And no. Of course, talking to everybody in the pawn, they all know him, you know, talking to everybody in the pawn shop about this and that. And nothing's quick with him. Third pawn shop we go to, he's scanning through the CDs. He pulls it, he goes, here we go. And he buys a CD for like $3, and it's Kris Kristofferson's Greatest Hits. I didn't know much about Kris Kristofferson at that time. I hadn't been educated in the band, but boy, did I get one that night. We get back in his pickup. He puts that Kris Kristofferson in. And he's like, Sunday Morning. He told me this. He says, Sunday Morning, that song right there is the reason that Kris Kristofferson got to quit working, Pooh Bear. Nobody does it better than him. He wrote that song from his own experience. You know, and he told me all these stories about how Kris Kristofferson was a helicopter pilot in the military and how he flew all these missions. And then he came back and he flew. I hadn't worked offshore yet. This is before I went to work offshore, but he flew for PHI, for Petroleum Helicopters Incorporated, down there offshore. He flew people back and forth to offshore jobs. And he told me some version of how he landed a helicopter in Johnny Cash's backyard and gave him Sunday Morning Coming Down. And that's how it became a hit, Johnny Cash. Listen to it. And it's a deeply moving song. When Kris Kristofferson, it's a completely different animal. It's way more melancholy. It's my favorite version nowadays. But around this time, we're on the way back to his apartment, and he won't know if we go to the liquor store or whatever. And I said, well, I brought you something from Mexico. I brought you these little buttons. And I got two of them left. And I was telling him all about my experiences with it. He hadn't been down that road. He said, sounds like a good time to me, Pooh Bear. Let's go. So we go back to his apartment. We don't go to the liquor store. We just go back to his apartment. And told him about all the throw. He said, I don't throw up. I don't throw up, man. My stomach's stronger than that. Boy, that man throwed up all that Mexican food. Yeah, we ate those things, puked our guts out. I was telling him about how that's supposed to be part of it. And after that part, it gets really good. And he brought his little boom box out there. He had this little thing set up with these two big old speakers and puts the Kris Kristofferson album in there. And I don't know how many times we listened to that album that night, but I know it was a lot. And the whole time I don't know how he knew a pawn shop was going to have a Kris Kristofferson album. Like, that's the magic of Uncle Bobby, is that's the shit about him I can't explain. Like, why we didn't just go to Walmart, why he knew that a freaking pawn shop was going to have a copy of Kris Kristofferson's album, or some album by Kris Kristofferson. Like that was the magic of who this dude was. We just listened to it on repeat on that mount, and he spent hours drilling me on what Chris was trying to say and talking to me about Bobby McGee and how she was a gal he really met in Morgan City. He knew everything about Chris Gustafson. Just, and then he go, what did I tell you this song meant, Pooh Bear? And he told me, he said, Chris is the real poet. The rest of them couldn't handle it. Chris was the real poet. Out of all the outlets, he's the guy. He was the real writer amongst the bunch. He's the only one who holds a candle is Willie. Chris was the poet. Chris was the man that made magical words. Chris told the truth. And I believe it's probably the only college course on Chris Gustafson in existence. Non-accredited, of course. We're tripping on them buttons, buddy. It had us a grand old time. And eat a whole one of the things, you only ride about 12 hours, and you're not going to do a lot of sleeping in that 12 hours. I think we both faded out about 7, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. Drank a bunch of water. Crashed out. Gives you, sometimes have a little headache. Woke up, a little headache, dehydrated. Hungry as shit. Because you ain't got nothing in your stomach. You're so hungry. There's this place over in Kilgore called the Hot Biscuit. And they ran a real long buffet, like breakfast buffet. Went for a long time. We'd only been asleep a couple hours, so we went over the Hot Biscuit and just gorged ourselves. Biscuits and gravy, everything you ever wanted, sausage, bacon. Just ate like we had never seen food before. Laughing the whole time, because it takes a while for it to completely go away. We went back to his place. He had a new movie on DVD. Or maybe it wasn't even DVD. I don't remember what we had at the time. But he had a new movie that he wanted me to see that he'd been watching. And it was called The Ninth Gate. And I watched that movie with him that day. And I watched that movie 3 or 4 times with my brother, and I'm still not 100% sure what that movie's about. But I think it's Johnny Depp buys a devil's book or something, or Satan's diary. I don't remember. A lot of people like it. It's a weird flick. I think because the way I saw it the first time, the way I was feeling, I was just struggling to understand it. Hung out with him that night. We didn't do it because it kind of, man, day after you need some rest. And we mostly just bullshit. We watched a couple other movies, crashed out. I got up next morning, hauled ass back to Houston, Sunday. But I had stuff that, you know, I had a new job starting and I needed to get back to Houston. I still hadn't really found me a place to live yet either. I kind of had like a little temporary spot, but then I was also I would go over and stay at my friend's house. I needed to kind of figure out some stuff. And I was kind of seeing that little gal, and then I decided to quit seeing her. Right before quit seeing her, I wrecked that motorcycle. I went to AutoZone on Derry Ashford to get something. And it was a pretty day out, and I had my helmet strapped onto the back of the seat behind me instead of on my head where it could have done some good. And I was bebopping down Richmond. Not a care in the world. And a lady backed out of her driveway in front of me. And I kind of careened off the back of her car and went off into the median. And immediately was thrown off the bike. And the bike flipped over a couple times. And I cartwheeled through the median. Thank God I wasn't on the street. And I remember watching my helmet bounce down the street. Thinking, boy, that would have been useful. Anyways, y'all know that story already. Eventually got that bike back together and wrecked it again. I learned some hard lessons on that motorbike. I think right after that, I bought a Honda Civic from my friend's dad. And it wasn't very long after that I got out of NDT for a while. That's when I got into the records and started. That one I did up. I think so. I don't remember. Be 100% with you. I was a whole mess back then. I couldn't tell you where I was or how long I was there or what I was even doing there to begin with. You know? Not a lot of lessons in this one. I don't think. Let's do some testimonials before we get out of here for the evening. We got a big old box over here to open too that I suspect is some Hot Wheels for the drivendreams.org. Charity. Oh, that is notes from the book. Don't need that right now. Let's see. At Texas Sam. Enjoy your hair while you have it. I'm 41 now and have been bald for 22 years. Brother, I'm trying. Mine's actually starting to thin a little bit. I never had problems with it ever in my life. And then in the last year or so, it's starting to thin up on top a little bit, so maybe I'm going to be bald like Uncle Bob. But you know what? I had it for 48 years. I guess I really can't complain. Doesn't mean I'm not going to try to do things to keep it. I've been doing, my wife made me some rosemary water or something. I sprinkle it, massage it on there. It's supposed to make your hair grow better or something else. But if it don't work, don't work. I'll go full Gene Hackman, go on with my life. Maybe grow a crazy a bullet, you know, a bald mullet combined. I don't know. Go Gallagher with it. Have fun. I always say if I go bald like that on top, I want to go just full Dwight Yoakam, like just the full fringe Dwight Yoakam. Just rock it. Lean into it. But I've had it a long time, so I can't even complain, you know. At Roger Vandina Beal 6209, 24 watching. Everyone give JW a like. Oh, I save that comment because I often forget to tell you guys this, but please, if you're watching, you're enjoying it, please give me the old like button, maybe hit the old subscribe button. You'll be notified of new episodes and all that. And all my stuff I make on YouTube. I do a lot of different things here. I always forget to ask y'all to do that, but I would appreciate if y'all do that. This show, it does all right, but it doesn't make a lot of income, and I spend a little more making it than I do get back from it. So all those likes and the subscribing to my YouTube, all that stuff helps out. It helps my numbers and helps the show do a little better and get recommended for more people. So I'd appreciate it if you guys do that, if you got the time. Which I don't ever need this show to make me money. This show I make for myself. This is everything else I do is pretty much transactional and income based. And I get to make this show the way I like to make it. And nobody owns any part of it. In fact, I've got the audio all back now and back up to snuff. And been thinking about putting the audio, somebody suggested putting the audio on Patreon and ad free for those that do want to contribute to the show or whatever, you know, so I may do something like that. I'll still leave it out there free for everybody on Spotify and everything, but I think I'm going to run an ad free version on Patreon. And I was thinking like $5 a month, that's a little over a dollar a show, you know, for those that want to do that. And no hard feelings either way, you know what I mean? No big deal. Just somebody suggest it. And I know there's people that would like to support that way. And I would like to give them the opportunity to do so. At Shaky Smoker One, another amazing episode. You keep going the way you are, you're going to need to drop down to a dang XL before season 3 starts. I know, I'm pretty psyched. Amy, I have still kind of technically been in 3X shirts. And Amy sent me this shirt in a 2X. And it actually fits. It's a little snug right now, but not bad. Like, I think within the next month or two, it's going to fit me real well, you know? So I'm excited. I am shedding pounds slowly but surely here. feels weird. I'm the smallest version of myself than I've been in about a decade right now, and I'm enjoying it. All right, that's our testimonials. Oh, let's not forget to unwrap our goodies here. Let's not forget to do that. Let me pull my episode notes back up. I don't want to forget anything. Oh, don't know who this is from yet. It says it's from Amazon Fulfillment Center. Get the old Freedom knife after it. Look at that note right on top. Hails, yeah. Oh, it still doesn't tell me who sent it. Holy crap. There are 250 packs in here. Dadgum, look at that. Oh, 50 pack. One. And do some rearranging over here. We have too many. Not too many. They're all just more little kids. We're going to give something to smile about. I'm just psyched about it. You guys just really blow my mind doing this. This is just beautiful. It's just a beautiful thing. And another 50 pack. Look at that. That's 100 smiles. Little kids. 100 smiles right there. It's a gift receipt. Where it went? No, tell me who sent it. That's what I really want to know. Oh, here we go. I think we got a note here. Oh, we got two notes. These are from two. This is nice. Cool. I'm thinking this might be a father and son or some brothers or something. A gift for you. Enjoy your gift from Glenn Malarkey Jr. Oh, it's same guy, I guess. Thank you for putting some good in the world, and thank you for telling stories that speak deeply to how I grew up. I hope you get enough cars that you need a dump trailer to drop them off. From Glenn Malarkey, Rambling Shenanigans. Glenn, thank you. It's magnanimous. I really appreciate it. These are 100 more smiles. 100 more smiles we get to make in October. And I am just tickled to death about it. I'm tickled to death to be the messenger. I was tickled to find this wonderful little charity these guys are doing, and I'm so excited to be a part of it. And don't forget, if you are in the Houston area, I am going to be at the Hot Wheels Legends Tour in August. I'm going to be one of the judges, and I'd love to see some fans that you come out there. We'll do meet and greet and take all the photos you want. I worked 20 years for people want to take pictures with me. We'll take all the damn pictures you want. Anything. Like, never feel weird if you see me out somewhere. Ask me about that. Unless I look really hungover. And then maybe feel weird about it. Just kidding. No, I'm not kidding. There, I'm really excited about doing the Hot Wheels thing again. It's just such an honor to get included. And I'm just tickled to death about that. And really looking forward to it. Love to see some people out there. Friendly faces. I don't got any good advice for you on this episode, I don't think, except stay away from the hard stuff, kids. And if you do try some peyote, try it in the desert, maybe throw some Chris Christopherson on. Best I can tell you. This episode made me think about work a lot, though. Made me think about how much of my life that I devoted to jobs and there's this Jason Isbell song I like. I think it's called Thank God for the Work. And it speaks to me on a very, very deep level. It really really gets to me. And I was listening to it earlier when I was writing the episode, and it hit me. I don't reckon I'll ever know what it feels like to be done with the work. Now, I mean, I know what it's like to be done working for today. you know, shut the laptop, put the tools away, to resign yourself that that'll do for now. You've done as much as you can do today. But done with all of it, I can't picture that. See, for me, the work ain't just a job. The work's how I've measured my own worth most of my life. I was taught early on, like a lot of folks, that a man's value lives in his output. That you are what you produce, what you build, what you can carry, how far you can carry. And I reckon that's both a gift and a curse. Because on one hand, the work gives me purpose. It makes me feel like I belong here. Like I'm not just burning daylight meant for someone else. But on the other hand, it means I don't know how to stop. There ain't no 6 days of labor and 1 day of rest for me. That rhythm, it don't fit me right. My body might quit for the night, but my mind, it just keeps churning. I write all night. I write all the time. I write all the time. The idea of being done with the work feels impossible, because if I ain't working, then who the hell am I? Truth is, my last day at work will probably be my last day on this earth. And strangely enough, I'm at peace with that. Because it is kind of funny when you stand back and look at it. We work our whole lives, pour ourselves into something that hopefully outlasts us, only to fade out like a radio signal on a bad ride home. And still somewhere out there, some guy in a suit's going to try to sell your widow a casket with a lifetime warranty. Lifetime warranty on a box that proves your warranty already ran out. That's life for you. It's a beautiful boneheaded tangle of contradiction. A beautiful boneheaded tangle of contradiction. We sweat and bleed and build and write and love and try, knowing most of us ain't gonna see how the story ends. And even still, even knowing all that, I can't imagine not doing the work, not creating things, not telling stories, not digging through all this mess, trying to pull a little truth or a little laughter out of some wreckage. So no, I don't think I'll ever be done with the work. And maybe that's okay, because the work, that's how I know I'm still here. And maybe that's how I've learned to love being here, even if I'm still figuring out whether that's the right way to measure it. I hope you have work that keeps you focused on being here. Work that you want to do until you can't do it no more. I'm rooting for you. Always. Always. I'm always rooting for you. There's room at the table for everyone, and I'd like to see you all succeed. I'm JW. I love you. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. Ain't worth nothing if feeling free. Feeling good wasn't enough. Bobby sings blues. Guys, these freaking Hot Wheels, I love y'all, man.